All right, okay, so I want to talk to you today about the most popular programming language in computer science. It's a very interesting language, widely used, but has no interpreter or compiler. Doesn't seem to have a specification written down everywhere. We're not quite sure who invented it, though these people designed some key features. And yet there are other features of the language whose history is actually rather difficult to trace. And I would tell you the name of the language, but it doesn't seem to have one, despite being the most popular programming language in computer science. So for the purpose of this talk, old habits die hard, I'm going to call it computer science metanotation. And in this language, you've got user-declared data types that are usually written out in the form of BNF, in Backus and Naur form. Its code is written in the form of inference rules, the so-called Gensen notation. We'll see examples of that in a minute. It has this very interesting, weird symbolic operation called capture-free substitution, for which we can thank Alonzo Church. And more recently, it has developed features for expressing repetition through means other than recursion. So overlines and ellipsis notation are going to be particular objects of study. And it's a very beautiful language, and unfortunately, in the last 10 to 15 years, it's getting badly messed up. And we may be approaching a crisis. I think we need to do something about it. So here's an example of computer science metanotation code. It's in the form of a Gensen inference rule. There's a conclusion below the line and some premises above the line. And the essence of it is that if you want to prove the thing below the line, all you need to do is prove the things above the line. And I've highlighted some things here to draw your attention to the fact that some things have been overlined. And the intent of those overlines is to indicate repetition of the thing before it. We're going to talk more about the precise nature of that repetition later on. Here's a different piece of code. This is taken from last year's Popple conference in 2016. This is a collection of 7 rules out of a much larger collection of about 30 or so rules. This is a type checker. And this shows how, given a context gamma, you can figure out what the type of an expression x is and say that its type is tau. And for each of the different possible kinds of expressions, we have a rule here. Now, I'm not going to dive into the details of this, but I'm going to point out that you can view each of these rules as being a kind of subroutine. The way to see that is to realize that you can regard the gamma and the expression to be looked at as inputs, and you want to get a type out. And given an expression, all you need to do is find the rule that matches that expression and then apply it. And choice of rule is the main source of conditionals in the language, non-deterministic dispatch to rule. Now, this particular program happens to be deterministic because the rules have been carefully written so that for any given form of expression, exactly one rule will match, or at most one rule will match. If none matches, then you've reached a situation where you aren't able to do the proof. But you can view each one as a subroutine where if you want to view what is below the line as a function signature, as sort of the entry point, then what is above it is the things you need to prove in order to prove the thing below the line. Therefore, that is the body of the subroutine. It's the things you have to execute in order to achieve the effect of the subroutine call. And here in the same code, I have highlighted 2 uses of dot, 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 the ellipsis, to indicate a sequence of things. And it's being used in 2 different ways here. In the premise, highlighted in yellow, it is being used as an iterator. And its intent is actually that the premise before it occurs a bunch of times, once for each value of I. Whereas in the conclusion below, it's being used to indicate a sequence in a single expression, that you have a bunch of m's that are being fed as an argument to this operator. And that's about all there is to say about that. But notice the use of ellipses to indicate some form of repetition in the language. Okay, so I hope that I've convinced you that it's a programming language. In fact, the code I just showed you is part of a complete type-checking algorithm. Now I want to show you that it's the most popular language in computer science, not in the use of not in computer applications, but in computer science. Here I did a study of the last 43 years of Popple, which is ever since its beginnings in 1973. This is the Principles of Programming Languages conference, and the total height of each bar is the number of papers in that conference. These are actually aggregated into 5-year intervals, and the light part of the bar at the bottom is the fraction of papers that are using inference rules as a part of their notation. And as you can see, the fraction of such papers has been growing. And for about the last 20 years, over half of all papers appearing in Principles of Programming Language conference have used this notation as part of their presentation, often as a central part of their presentation. But what about other conferences? Well, I looked at the last 3 years of PLDI, of UPSLA, of ICFP, the International Conference on Functional Programming, and PPOP is a control. That's the Principles and Practice of Parallel Programming. And you can see about a third of PLDI papers in the last 3 years are using this notation, about a third of OOFSLA papers, roughly two-thirds of functional programming papers, and almost none of the papers in the conference on parallel processing, because the parallel processing conference tends to focus more on what's going on at runtime than what's going on at compile time. Computer science metanotation tends to be used to describe compilers and their associated algorithms. Nevertheless, it's a very widely used notation. So in order to produce these results, I had to eyeball these papers manually, or I should say ocularly, because unfortunately, the essence of this notation is that horizontal line that indicates the Gensen notation. That's not captured by OCR. And so it was necessary to actually physically get the paper proceedings out of the library. I've got copies of them all, of course, and flip them over, looking at it page by page. Oh, there's some Gensen notation. I take notes. So I've studied about 25,000 pages of computer science papers in order to distill these results. Okay, now I'd like to talk about some aspects of this notation. The first is the use of Backus-Naur form. Here is the Backus-Naur form as originally designed by Backus. This is used in his initial report on the International Algebraic Language in 1959. And you can see that this is typed with a typewriter and then has a bunch of things drawn in by hand, the overlines over the word or, and the equivalent sign is actually an equal sign with an extra line drawn in below by hand, that kind of stuff going on. The angle brackets are drawn in by hand. So this is a very labor-intensive notation in the day. When this report was revised the next year, Peter Naur was the editor. It was published in CACM. And the notation had changed a bit, partly to make it much easier to keyboard, and partly Naur instituted the convention that the non-terminals of the grammar should be English phrases that correspond with English phrases used in the text describing a language, so you could easily see the correspondence. And it's for those contributions that Knuth wrote a letter indicating that it ought to be called not Backus normal form, but Backus Naur form. But since then, the various other versions of BNF have occurred. I've unearthed 20 or 30 different variations. I'll just show you three or four. This is the notation that's used to describe the Bliss programming language in 1970. Instead of the colon, colon, equals, there's a little right arrow there. And what's interesting is that in this document, the notation was just taken for granted, even though it was a variant. They just said, here's the grammar. Did not describe the notation used to write the grammar. In 1977, Niklaus Wirth noticed that there were a bunch of different variations of BNF, and he thought this was causing confusion, so he decided to solve the problem by presenting yet another variant. And it's actually a pretty nice one, and 20 years later, it became an international standard, which is now widely ignored. In part because the next year, Karen Henrici published their book on the C programming language and used yet a different version of notation, which is obviously BNF. But here, instead of having vertical bars to separate the choices, they just put them on separate lines. The colon, colon, equals is shrunk to single colon. And there are two different versions depending on whether the alternatives are single symbols or are phrases. And this has been widely used to describe C, C++, Java, C sharp, F sharp, and other languages. Okay, so we've seen a bunch of different varieties of BNF over the last six decades, and this largely hasn't been a problem. People seem to accommodate to it, and I think that's because the elements of the structure of the notation always appear in the same order, whatever the variant, the punctuation changes, but roughly the notation stays the same. And so when a student or a veteran of 40, 45 years like me walks up to a paper and sees, oh, that looks roughly like BNF, I think I can figure it out, that's fine. And in fact, the version we use in computer science papers is very different from any of those. Here's an example taken from a 2014 Pubble paper. Here's some BNF, and it's obviously BNF has got the colon, colon, equals, it's got the vertical bar, but instead of using English phrases from the non-terminals, we've got single letters here instead, often Greek letters. And so the mnemonic value of the non-terminals has gone away. And so suddenly comments appear. So instead of having uncommented BNF that was self-describing, now we've got this very compressed BNF for which we need comments so we can tell what's going on. Okay, so why have we gone to single letters? Also notice in this BNF, the use of the overline to indicate repetition, whereas in original BNF, one would have used recursion. In the last few lines of this BNF, you'll see overlines to indicate that elements are repeated. Well, I believe that there is an obvious evolutionary pressure to make BNF more and more and more concise, and in fact, to make CSM more and more and more concise, which explains a lot of its structures. And that evolutionary pressure is conference page limits. And as the algorithms become more and more complicated and the page limits don't change, we are driven to make the notation ever more and more concise. I think this is real, and this is something we need to worry about. You know, this is something, this has been sort of implicit all along, but I'm a language designer, and I want to think about what are the consequences of this for the future design of this language as it evolves. And there are implications. Okay, another couple of interesting aspects about BNF that I have not seen remarked upon before, and so this is my own contribution, I think it's the source of my own analysis, which is there are a couple of conventions about how we use BNF. If we took the definition of BNF literally and used it everywhere, it says that wherever you see a non-terminal, you can replace it with an expansion described by the right-hand side of the rule for that non-terminal. So if we took that definition literally, then we could replace every non-terminal by a string derived from that non-terminal. And if we were to write an English sentence such as, a value of type taw may be assigned to any variable of type taw, well, taw is a BNF non-terminal. It expands to a data type. It can expand int. It can expand a bool. So let's expand the first instance to int and the second to bool. Now we have a value of type int may be assigned to any variable of type bool, which is not what we want. It's nonsense. Instead, we have this implicit convention about consistent substitution when a non-terminal appears anywhere but on the right-hand side of a BNF rule, if it appears in an English sentence or paragraph, or if it appears in an inference rule, this is very important, then we depend upon consistent substitution. If a non-terminal is mentioned more than once, the same expansion must be used for each occurrence. So we get a sentence of the form, a value of type int may be assigned to any variable of type int. There's a second related rule. If we took the definition of BNF literally and replaced every non-terminal by a string derived from that non-terminal, even if we obey the consistent substitution rule, then we have a sentence such as, if taw1 equals taw2, then taw1 is a subtype of taw2. That would be expanded with, say, taw equaling int to, if int sub 1 equals int sub 2, then int sub 1 is a subtype of int sub 2. But that's not usually what we want to say. Instead, we have this implicit convention that when you decorate a non-terminal, and what I mean by decoration is things like subscripts or primes or accent marks or possibly little subscripted names. We recognize such a decorated non-terminal as in effect being a distinct non-terminal that has the same productions as the undecorated form. And this allows us to produce such sentences from your thing up at the top as, if int equals bool, then this is, int is a subtype of bool. Now, in fact, that is a true sentence because int is not equal to bool. We have consistently substituted for taw1 and for taw2. And we also get the sentence, if int equals int, then int is a subtype of int. Yay. The point of all of this is that we have implicit conventions about this programming language that have not been carefully written down up to now. And they have to do with being very careful about what things must be the same and what things are allowed to be different. And what more important distinction could there be when you're worrying about your mathematical notation and your computer science notation is keep being very careful about when things must be the same and when they need not be. So now let's talk about substitution. The substitution notation, was introduced by Alonzo Church in 1932 when he was worrying about formulas and substituting for variables and formulas. In 1941, he published the Calculi of Lambda Conversion. And here there's a crucial difference. In 1932, he simply spoke of substituting an expression for a variable everywhere it appears in another expression. That's all he says. But in 1941, he says, to replace any part of a formula by this substitution, provided that the bound variables of M are distinct both from X and from the free variables of N. So at this point, this becomes capture-free substitution, which has been a very important idea in computer science. Okay, and so of course, now we use this notation to this day, not. Nowadays, we tend to write something like this. I'm not quite sure where this notation came from. I've been trying to trace its roots. We write something like, the expression produced by substituting the value v, or the value expression v, for the variable x within the expression e. And we write something like that. So, but other variations are seen in computer science. Any guesses as to how many different variations of this notation are in the literature? 43. All right, do I hear any other bids? Okay. Okay. Well, for Popple, from 1973 to 2016, I documented 28 different varieties. And they're shown here in this table. And the usage has grown over time. Substitution is, in the last 5 years, has been used in over one-third of Popple papers. The inference rule's in over half, but substitution in over a third. And we see all these different variations. You say, oh, well, it keeps changing over the years. But in fact, the number of variations has grown over the years. if we look at other computer science conferences as well, then in just the then I've been able to document 31 variations, of which 15 were used at Popple in the last 5 years and 5 more at other SigPlan conferences in the last 3 years. So that tells us out of these 31 variations, 20 are now in live use. Why are there so many variations? I haven't quite been able to figure that out. So, well, we had variations of BNF, and that hasn't been a problem for the last 6 decades. But I think it is a problem for substitution because these variations don't just change the punctuation, they change the structure. They change where the V and the X and the E are. And so when you walk up the notation, you can't easily guess which piece is supposed to be which. And so we have a couple of problems. One is a moderate problem. By far the most popular form is E with a postfix set of brackets and V before X in the slash. But at once every 5 years, we see this other version that gets it backwards. It has the X before the V. And you can't count on the variable names to tip it off because different authors use different variable names. I even found one paper published last year that used both forms with no comment or explanation. I assume that one of them was a typo and I can't tell which one. Okay, so that's a moderate problem. The more difficult problem is that some of these forms, particularly the ones using the maps to arrow and the colon equals, and also the variants that are prefix rather than postfix and use braces instead of brackets, those forms are fairly frequently used. They're used in about 1/6 of all Popple papers. So these forms are fairly common, but they are also widely used for a completely different purpose, for function update, also known as map update or heap update or storage update, standing for this notation down here at the bottom. A function f updated so that x maps to v when applied to z is, if z is x, then return v, otherwise return f of z. So it changes f, so at just one point in its domain, it has a different value in its range. And that kind of feels like substitution. There's this vague idea of, yeah, we're changing one thing to be another thing. We're substituting this value for this particular variable. This is actually a very different operation. Substitution has this whole extra piece of machinery where it goes groveling through an expression and dealing with avoiding the captures, the variable captures. And none of that is a part of the function update thing. So if you see a paper and you just see this notation in the middle of it, you're unsure whether it's function update or substitution. And often they're both kinds of notation are used in a single paper. And lately, most authors, under the pressure of conference page limits, are not taking the space for that paragraph that explains their notation. They're just taking their version of the notation for granted. And it's become very hard to review papers. In fact, I started this entire investigation in metanotation because I noticed in reviewing papers for ACM the last 4 or 5 years, I'm having more and more trouble reading the notation because the authors aren't telling me which variation they're using. So much for substitution. I think we've got a problem with substitution. Now let's talk about overlines. Here's a history of the overline notation, all compressed into one slide. Believe me, I could spend 2 hours just telling you about the history of the overline. But let's go through this. In 1484, Chiquet used an underline to group symbols to be a single mathematical expression. In 1525, Rudolph used dots. So that dot means that the initial square root symbol is a little more separated from the rest of it. As a result, the addition happens before that initial square root. In 1556, Tertullius started using parentheses for mathematical grouping, very different notation. In 1631, Ottred used a double dot to indicate grouping in the same way that Rudolph used single dots. Why did Ottred use a double dot? Because he wanted to use single dot for something else. Okay. In 1637, René Descartes attached an overline as a grouping symbol to the surd indicating square roots, producing our modern square root symbol. And this is where the overline as a grouping survives most widely in our current mathematical notation. In 1640, Jan Stampoen used all three together. He added together three terms, and then he put them in parentheses, and then he drew an overline, and then he put a dot just to make sure. He was taking no chances, so whatever notation his reader was familiar with, they had a fighting chance of understanding what he meant. 6 years later, Van Schooten, editing the works of Vieta, decided to use overline for grouping of mathematical expressions. Leibniz also used overline early in his career, but in 1702, he shifted to using parentheses, and the reason was technological. He said the parentheses are much easier for the typesetter, setting type by hand, than to deal with in overlines. And so he recommended a changeover from the overlines to parentheses. And in fact, 6 years later, Acta Eruditorum, I love the title of that journal, Acta Eruditorum, the Acts of the Erudite, officially adopted the Leibnizian symbolism and switched over to using parentheses. And a little later in that century, Euler and two of the Bernoullis widely popularized the use of parentheses, and I think it's due to their writings that we now use parentheses so widely today. But a century later, Giuseppe Peano, as in, you know, piano arithmetic, decided to use dots instead. And so he reintroduced the use of dots, and he used both single and double dots and occasionally triple dots. And you can think of the number of dots as corresponding to binding weakness. So A colon B C dot D means, well, B and C have no dots between them, so they bind first. And then that product binds to D because there's a single dot there, and then to A because of the double dot. And that might have died, except that Russell and Whitehead decided to use Peano's dots, thereby keeping the notation alive and making their work much harder to read a century later in a parenthesis world than it would have been otherwise. So here we see that for five centuries, there have actually been three competing notations for grouping of mathematical expressions, duking it out. And except for Principia Mathematica, it kind of looks like parentheses have won, except that now we're seeing the overline come into wide use in computer science, not only to indicate grouping, but also repetition. And so how did that happen? Well, first I need to make a digression into the history of vectors. Okay, so in 1813, Argand, you know, of the Argand diagram, graphs complex numbers, speaks of the square root of minus one as describing a rotation of the plane, and proposes the arrow notation for vectors. Notice that this over arrow actually kind of groups the symbols A and B together, indicating the start and the end point of the vector. 20 years later, Hamilton recast the theory of complex numbers as a pure algebra on pairs of reals. He didn't want to think about imaginaries, he was just thinking about an algebraic structure. And so he really liked this algebra on reals and decided to try to find corresponding algebras for tuples of length 3 and greater. And he particularly focused on triplets, and after 10 difficult years, finally discovered the quaternions, which are actually four tuples. They're like complex numbers with I, J, and K. And the I, J, and K correspond to the triplets he was looking for, but he discovered that he sort of needed this extra thing in there. What was that about? So a few years later, he managed to reformulate quaternions without using explicit coordinates, describing the quaternion as the sum of a scalar and an imaginary vector. And a few decades after that, James Maxwell used quaternions to describe electricity and magnetism. His first works were written using quaternions. And he made some mild criticism about how awkward the quaternions were to use. And not long after that, Gibbs established dot and cross for our dot and cross product symbols. They haven't been around forever. They're fairly recent as mathematics goes. And then in 1882, Oliver Heaviside, the physicist, advocated ditching the scalar part of quaternions and simply using vectors. And here's why. Quaternions are kind of awkward to use, in part because the vector is imaginary. So when you try to find the length of a vector, you take the dot product with itself, but because it's imaginary, the length comes out negative. So you end up having to put in a minus sign. And when you're working with quaternions, you find these minus signs constantly popping up in places that are physically unintuitive. So Heaviside says, forget the scalar part of quaternions. Yeah, it's algebraically pretty, but let's just use the vector part and not worry about the signs nearly as much. And there's a big fight in the 1890s between the quaternionists and the vectorists and physicists in physics. The quaternionists pointed to the beautiful complete algebra. I mean, quaternions are a field. But unfortunately, they only describe the three-dimensional case. Right? They're great for describing rotations in three space. They're still used in video games to this day for that purpose. But vectors have a much cruder and clumsier algebra. The multiplication is badly behaved. In fact, dot and cross products are not true products. They're just these weird binary operations on vectors. But they have the virtue of being very convenient, and they have the virtue of generalizing to more than three dimensions. And they eventually won out. And we can be thankful. This is where they entered into computer science. My physicist friends cringe, but in 1975 to 81, we see both A with an overline and A with a little arrow over it used to denote a vector, by which a computer scientist doesn't mean this thing that transforms by in certain ways in physical space. They just mean a list of components, in other words, a one-dimensional array. So it's kind of a bastardization of the concept. But the word vector or list or sequence or set are all used to describe this idea of a sequence of things A sub 1 through A sub M. And by 81, that notation is taken for granted, at least in Popple papers. And by 89, the enclosures, the angle brackets, the parentheses, the braces are no longer required. The notation X with an over arrow over it is described as indicating an unenclosed sequence of things, but comma separated. So far, the semantic model being used by the computer science appears to be that overline marks a variable as representing a sequence. But there's a corresponding syntactic model, which is that you just make copies of the overline name and spread them out from left to right and attach sequential subscripts starting from one. And that is its meaning in a paper. The next year, we see an explicit claim that, in fact, the thing that is overlined may be a metasyntactic variable, that is a non-terminal of the BNF. And also in that same year, we see this stretching in the notation for what I call an implicit unit replication. A paper writes M with an overbar, and then a colon, and then sigma with an overbar, where M is a variable name and sigma is a type, and uses it to mean M1 colon sigma 1 dot 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 MK colon sigma K, rather than to mean a bunch of M's, then a single colon, and then a bunch of sigmas. So in other words, the overline has kind of been distributed in this weird way in the writing, but the intent is that a single larger syntactic unit get replicated. On the other hand, 3 years later, we see a claim that overline may simply be applied to any syntactic object. So that author would write the same thing by writing an overline over the whole expression, not separately over M and sigma. Okay, but this introduces a problem. We'll get to it in a moment. In 94, we see the first use of nested overlines. Ooh, what does that mean? Computer scientists always generalize. In 96, we see the overline notation taken for granted, but an explicit statement of convention that had been assumed for about 20 years up to that point. We implicitly assume that when we write something like Z overline slash Y overline, that the two sequences have the same length. They are constrained to have the same length by the very fact that they are used in the notation in this way. And the next year, we see the first general statement of the idea of pointwise extension. By abusive notation, operations on singletons are implicitly extended pointwise to sequences where those sequences are indicated by overlines. And this is where we run into a problem. The problem is, what does this expression up here mean? Gamma of a bunch of B's equals a bunch of P's with the substitutions applied with a bunch of T's and a bunch of X's. What does this mean? Well, if we apply the principle of pure pointwise extension to both the substitution notation and the equality notation, then this single concise statement up here, remember concision is important, that single concise statement stands for a conjunction of equalities such as gamma of B sub 1 equals T sub 1 substituted for X sub 1 in P sub 1, and so forth, all the way up to B sub n equals the substitution of T sub n for X sub n in P sub n. But unfortunately, that's not what the authors intended by that notation. What they really wanted was this more elaborate conjunction at the bottom, where the B's and the P's correspond and have to be the same length, and the T's and X's correspond and have to be the same length, but it might be a different same length. And the intent is to use the same substitution in all of the equations, where each substitution is multivariable, rather than each substitution having a single variable and a single expression. That was the intent. But somehow the notation didn't quite capture that. So what's going on there? So a solution is nested overlines. Some authors would instead have written it this way to indicate that the T's and the X's go together, the B's and the P's go together. This seems natural, but how do we know that the gamma doesn't also get subscripts? Because we've got this tension. And finally, we arrived at an essential contradiction. In about the last 15 years, we are seeing many papers wanting both of these usages. We want this kind of substitution equation with a double overline to indicate this conjunction where the substitutions are all the same, and V and X are the same length but represent the same substitution in each equation. But on the other hand, we also want to describe a case construct where we have a bunch of case clauses. Each case clause has a bunch of variables. We want different sets of variables Y in each case clause. And in fact, those sequences Y might be of different lengths in each clause. And with a purely syntactic theory, we can't have it both ways. We have an essential contradiction in the notation. And this is the crisis I think we've come to. And so I have a proposal for solving it. And inspired by the consistent substitution convention, actually, and I propose to borrow an idea from quasi-quoting. In Lisp, back in the 1970s, and in Scheme, there's this idea of writing an S expression with a back quote before it to indicate you're pleased to make a copy of the following S expression, but places marked by a comma say except here. What follows the comma is an expression whose value is to be used in the copy instead. So here this means make a copy of this lambda expression, but the variable vars and the variable body themselves have values that are to be stuck into the copy. This idea was also used for parallelism in connection machine Lisp, a language that Danny Hillis and I designed in 1986. And in this notation, alpha marks an expression that is to be executed many times in parallel. So it means execute many copies of the expression, but the bullet indicates except here. The value of the expression following the bullet is a vector, a one-dimensional array. So please use a different element of that vector in each copy. So here this means we've got a bunch of temperatures, and we're going to multiply each temperature by 9/5 and then add 32, thereby doing the usual Celsius to centigrade to Fahrenheit conversion. So the point is that the idea is to have an expression of which you're going to make a copy or many copies, but you have a way of marking exceptions. Well, now look at the overline notation. What the overline notation is indicating is the stuff under me, please make many copies. But we want to control the relationships to those copies. So the proposal is that in computer science meta notation, that the overline over str means expand any number of copies of str. They might be comma separated or something. That's a separate part of the convention. And each copy may be expanded differently. In particular, BNF non-terminals in the copies may be expanded differently. To put it yet another way, in each copy, each BNF non-terminal is given a different subscript. And because it's decorated differently, it may expand differently. But we will use an underline to mean except here. Underlined portions of the str must be expanded the same way in each copy. And with this simple convention, we can write both of these two examples. For the substitution example, we simply put an underline under the bracket part of the substitution notation. It means that part has to be the same in each copy. That, in turn, contains an overline and then causes it to get a bunch of V's and X's. But the substitution will be the same in each copy. On the other hand, for the case clauses, we write the two overlines with no underline, and that indicates that Y may be expanded differently in each copy. And for our third example, gamma of B equals T/X substituted into P, we use the overlines in the same way, but again, the underline is used to indicate the same substitution in each copy, and an underline is used to indicate the same gamma in each copy, so gamma doesn't get subscripts attached. And this seems to cover about 90% of the uses that I am seeing in computer science papers, and the other 10% would have to be covered by more explicit use of subscripts rather than trying to use the very concise overline notation. I think underlines would do the job. Okay, now let's look at ellipsis very quickly. I only have two slides to say about ellipsis. One is that it's not well defined. I have not seen a single computer science paper that has actually stopped to describe what this notation means. And here's a quote. Most readers will encounter the dot, dot, dot notation already. It is notation that is rarely introduced properly. Most leaders just use that explanation as in, for example, and here's the example. And the intent is, that these are all the integers from 1 to 20 being added up. In the past, we've used ellipsis to explain the overline. Whenever the overline is explained in a computer science paper, it is invariably explained using the dot, dot, dot notation. So over bar x means x sub 1, comma, dot, 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 comma, x sub n. But what does that dot, dot, dot mean? Well, it gets used in two very different ways in computer science meta notation. One is to say, there's some stuff missing here, and I expect it to conform to a pattern. And you're supposed to guess what that pattern is from the two endpoints, or from whatever context I provided. But the other meaning is dot, dot, dot means there's stuff missing here, and I don't care at all what it looks like. And unfortunately, those two uses are also mixed in papers and not explained. My proposal is to provide a formal theory of the overline notation that does not use dot, dot, dot in its exposition, and then to explain the dot, dot, dot by transformation into the overline notation. And there's a great formal theory of that, which I don't have time, it won't fit in the margin here. And I could spend 2 hours talking about that as well, but I will spare you. Okay, so some conclusions about my investigations. I believe that computer science meta notation is a symbolic programming language with its own distinctive syntax, semantics, and idioms. And I believe it should be an explicit object of study in the computer science community. It's a living language. It's changed a lot over the last four notations, and some of its notational ideas have roots that go back for centuries. And we are now encountering problems and inconsistencies because no one is designing this language. It's just that every author, in good faith, is doing his best to use the language well and to stretch its limits of expressiveness without having any specification to resort to. That this is one central place we can all agree on. So we've now encountered problems with substitution and with overlines and with lack of definition, dot, dot, dot. These can be fixed. And I believe we should develop a complete formal theory of the language. I've tried to make a start on that. And I think we should apply the techniques we apply to other programming languages like C and Python to CSM and build interpreters and compilers and IDEs and correctness checkers. We should be able to translate this notation into Coq and other proof checkers, as well as write interpreters for it and have other tools. And there are interesting opportunities for parallel execution of this language. The repetition notations offer obvious opportunities for parallelism. And there may be use for parallel algorithms and associated tools. So that's what I've been investigating over the last several months. And what does this have to do with Harry? Well, in fall of 1974, I took Applied Math 208. And on the left, you can see the syllabus. And on the right, you can see the first page of my notes. And I know that it was Harry that taught it, because at the top, I wrote very carefully Harry Lewis and underlined Harry.
Now, is that the appropriate use of underline?
Yes. Why did I underline Harry? Well, because I was also taking Applied Math 207 at the same time. That was being taught by Forbes Lewis. So I showed up for Forbes' class and wrote the professor's name at the top and took my notes. And then I got to Harry's class a little later, you know, that afternoon. Said, oh no, Harry Lewis, and I underlined Harry to be sure that I would pay attention. And Harry was at pains to point out that Applied Math 208 was not the same as Applied Math 207, nor any of several other courses. One was a theory of computation course, and but the Applied Math 208 was a little bit of Turing machines, and then propositional calculus and predicate logic. And you can tell from my notes that I was a very diligent and attentive student. Well, some of those notes are actually good notes, I think. But I want to show you the notes I took at the second and third classes. He started off by talking about Turing machines, and somehow I got it in my head to call them tuning machines. Just because I was feeling silly. And then I wrote out a little tune, which I didn't remember. When I tried to sing it, I realized it was, love divine, all loves excelling joy of, and then I ran out of paper. Okay, so that's that little tune written there. And okay, that's probably about all there is to say about that. But in this next set of notes, more about tuning machines, and I'm still silly. I was taking a course in ancient Greek that same semester, so you can see I'm practicing my Greek alphabet in the margins. And so here's a description of Turing machines. What I want to draw your attention to here is that I'm using a highly abbreviated notation, you know, in order to take my notes quickly by hand. You'll notice I always abbreviate the word theorem as THM. And I use the upside down A and the backwards E liberally as a abbreviation. So for all Turing machines M, there exists a Turing machine M prime such that yada, 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 yada. And we see more of that on the next page. On the next page, you also see a reference to Church's thesis. In the margin, I've drawn a little church that is labeled Alonzo. There also seems to be a reference to Martin Luther there. I'm not quite sure what that's about. And again, a little further down, you can see, there exist problems unsolvable by a Turing machine. So again, the use of that backwards E to indicate that. Harry was very long-suffering and patient. I liked him, and I felt comfortable with him, and I felt like I could get away with stuff. So in some of my problem sets, I would stick in quotations that I thought were relevant. Here's one from Nietzsche. It is not enough to prove something. You must seduce people into accepting it. To a wise man, nothing is strange. That was an exercise sentence from my Greek class. That's up at the top. Oh, from one of my favorite comic strips, BC. BC says, you're right, Peter, the world probably is round. I have faith in you. When one has faith, one doesn't need proof. And Peter scowls and says to himself, oh, ye of little proof. In other words, there is value in having proof. So I like that quote. And from Walt Cully's Pogo comic strip, Seminole Sam says, we must take the truth by the horns. And Al comments, a dilemma. And of course, there's a pun there because a dilemma is a horn. And Seminole Sam says, right, we're, I can't read it there, I need to read it up here. Right, we're standing with our feet buttered on a pool of ball bearings. The truth is tricky. One man's truth is another man's cold broccoli. I think those are words to live by. Walt Kelly had a way with words. And Harry put up with all this stuff, but finally at one point, I think he reached the breaking point. And when I put up this Latin anagram, quid est veritas? And he wrote, where the hell did you get this? Of course, this line in Latin is attributed to Pontius Pilate, and it has been anagrammed into words that mean roughly, it is the man who stands before you, or it is the man who is present here. And where the hell did you get this? Well, Harry, after 42 and a half years, I'm going to answer your rhetorical question. I would like to say that I found it while browsing through Samuel Johnson's Dictionary of the English Language, where he actually uses it as an example of an anagram. Yeah, I wish I could say this, but the truth is that I found it in the funny papers. And it was mentioned in Ripley's Believe It or Not. And you can see from the other examples that I pay much more attention to the comics pages than I do to erudite writings. But there's a couple other things. I was brash, and I decided to present some of my problems set in the form of Lisp code rather than giving an English explanation. So I just wrote at the bottom, Lisp code is naturally more readable than English algorithms. To which Harry kindly provided, you know, a very gentle corrective for certain algorithms, but try describing the theta of 3n median finder in Lisp. And indeed, that is a more difficult problem. So he had just the right amount of pushback to sort of guide me on the path and let me, you know, be headstrong in certain ways, you know, as long as I was sort of understanding the material. But here's the thing I want to draw your attention to. I mentioned before that I was using these abbreviations, these for alls and these exists. And that was okay as long as we were talking about Turing machines, and then sort of okay when we were talking about propositional calculus. Then we got to the predicate calculus. And somewhere in my notes, I have this very vivid memory, and I haven't identified it precisely, but I think that it was as I was about to transcribe this line here from the blackboard, as near as I can remember. But I've got this very vivid memory that as Harry was writing stuff on the blackboard and I was copying it down, that he wrote something of roughly the form upside down AX and then some stuff, if and only if, for all x, yada, yada. And I realized I was about to transcribe it in this way. And I suddenly realized, oh, what he wrote was very profound and connected syntax to semantics. And I was about to write a trivial syntactic tautology that had no content. And it was at that moment that I remember really appreciating the difference between syntax and semantics. Understanding the difference between notation and its meaning and their very subtle connection. And so that is my memory of that course. And so I want to thank you, Harry, for teaching me some very important things about notation and about logic and about truth. Thank you.